This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you by the Portland Magic Jam, which is going to be taking place March 22nd through the 24th in, of all places, Portland, Oregon. And registration is now open. This is usually a pretty intimate convention, but they're hoping to expand this year and have more people attend. Certainly more people should know about this because of the outstanding lineup that they always have. This year is going to be featuring people like David Regal, Tom Bergoon, Robert Ramirez, and Jonathan Levitt. It should be fantastic. And apparently this is like their 10th year. Well, more on this a little bit later, but I want to thank them very much for sponsoring this week's episode. Well, this week we're going to be having the first of a two-part chat we have with Richard Hatch, who is the H in the H&R Magic Books that many of you have purchased books through them in the past and know that well-known magic name. And it has, so many years ago, they haven't disbanded. They just kind of went to different ways. Richard and Dick used to live here in Houston, Texas, and Richard moved to Utah, and Charlie Randall stayed here, but they ended up selling the H&R Magic Book name really to Marshall Peterson, who is living just outside of Houston. So the magicbookshop.com is still operating. And in this podcast, Richard talks a little bit, actually quite a bit, about the beginnings of how they got started. So in case some of you are thinking about, well, how can I get my magic business started? And, you know, I think that, as Eugene Berger has said, that magic is a house with many rooms. And that would mean to me that there are opportunities for finding success in different ancillary kinds of activities, in particular that you don't necessarily have to be a performer, although that Richard Hatch is a fine performer and teacher and scholar and also a lecturer. But he and a bibliophile, quite erudite. And so he, I'm just saying that he has found a niche in the market that he really enjoys reading. And so if there's something that you enjoy also, you might be able to find a way to make a niche market for yourself then as well. And so you might take a tip from some of the suggestions that that he talks about in this podcast in our chat here this week. But not only that, one of the things that has been of intense interest over the years among magicians, and that is, who is S.W. Erdenace, which is the name that is on the title of the, showing as the author of the book, The Expert at the Card Table, which, of course, is a treatise that had inspired the professor, Di Vernon, and many generations of other magicians as well, and still to this day stands as a classic and something that many of us study and go back and learn the diagonal palm shift and so many other things that are in the book. It's wonderful. But the person who was Erdenace is still a mystery. In fact, there's a documentary that is going out on this, and trying to find who this person is. And in fact, I had spoken with the person who is the documentarian who is working on this. And if you'll go back and take a look at one of the episodes, just do a search for Erdenace and you'll find it, because he's still, I think, trying to raise more money in order to defray some of his expenses for that documentary. It's fantastic. And so there are several people, including Richard Hatch, who have ideas of who they think was this mystery man. So this week, we will talk with Dick about H&R Magic Books and then also his search for who this mystery author was. And then we will conclude that next week in part two, in which that he will conclude that part of his search and then also talk about some other magicians that he has been looking into that I find quite fascinating. And he is really a history buff, a magic history buff in particular. And he can get you interested, I think, in this as well. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Richard Hatch, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for TheMagicWordPodcast.com. And today, it gives me great pleasure actually to talk with someone who's a really close friend, someone that I've known for years, and we're going to get into a lot of stuff that he's been doing and currently doing, and talk about some history. You guys around the world know him. A lot of times whenever I would talk with the guests, sometimes they are my friends, but you don't know them yet until after you finish the podcast. This is a gentleman whose name you have known. You've seen probably at magic conventions at, around the world, along with his other business partner, the R part of the H&R. And this guy has published book, written books, and is well-known throughout the magic and respected throughout the magic community. And I've worked with him a long number of years, the Magic Island. In fact, we've got a, maybe we'll get around to an interesting story about the night we had the disappearing magicians from the Magic Island. There's so many great things we can get into. He had written the book, the definitive book on Hofstetter.
Translated.
That, okay. And I guess Hofstetter wrote it. You kind of translated. Well,
we can get into that if you want.
And, of course, is one who has done a lot of in-depth research on Erdenace and has also spoken at the collector's meeting, conference on history and magic. I always get that confused. That's what that's called. Mm-hmm. And also fluent in several languages, a master's in physics.
Physics.
Mm-hmm. And so a little few things you may not know about this gentleman. So that's enough as to whether you would call him Richard or Dick. It's your choice. It's kind of like day or die, I guess. You know?
That's right.
Either or either.
Well,
my good friend, Richard Hatch. Hey, Dick.
Hey, Scott. Good to see you again.
And it's always good to see and have a chance to talk with you also. And there are so many things that I want to talk about and things that are going on. Right now you're in Utah because whenever that we'd first gotten to know each other, it's kind of funny. It goes way back when I was in Omaha.
You were in Omaha still, yeah.
Yeah, and that Walter Graham had told me, because he was the one who had
printed
your
book. He published the translation, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
1985.
Yeah, how'd you get hooked up with Walter way back when?
You know, someone put me in. I didn't know him at the time. I approached a couple of magic publishers with the book, Mike Caveney, David Meyer, and somewhere along the line they said, you know, the guy for your book that we recommend to do it would be Walter Graham in Omaha.
Yep.
And I had an opportunity to meet him probably at a magic history conference or magic collectors gathering or something. And my wife and I were driving cross country. We were both students in New Haven, Connecticut. She was going to the Yale School of Music. I was going to the graduate school studying physics then. But we drove cross country and stopped in Omaha, spent the night with him. And he had fabulous collection, as you know, all that David P. Abbott stuff. And showed him the manuscript and started to go back and forth. And he got pretty enthusiastic. So we worked out an agreement.
Right.
And so the book was published in 1985. So I must have met him in 83 or 84.
Right.
And then he had to, at that time, you know, it was pre-computer in a way that he would do cut and paste layouts with his typesetting equipment, whatever it was. Modern Litho was the company.
Yes, Modern Litho. Mm-hmm.
And he had put out a couple of other magic historically related books, mostly reprints of old books, you know, Hocus Pocus Jr., that kind of thing.
Right.
So he tapped into that market. And when it came, or before it came out, he kind of to beat the drum, it was arranged for me to give a talk at the Magic Collectors Weekend, which at that time was held every year at the little theater at Magic Inc. Mm-hmm. that Jay Marshall hosted it. And actually, most of the talks were down the street at a church basement because the little theater wasn't big enough. It had outgrown that. But that was a great experience. I give a talk on Hofstetter, and you know, all my heroes were in the audience. Harry Blackstone Jr., Ricky Jay. I think Doug Henning came through. He didn't actually wasn't there for my talk. He was in town for shows or something. But I stopped by and you know, shook hands and signed stuff. It was just great. I was in heaven. But the thing I remember is in the talk I gave an anecdote. There was a newspaper account of Hofstetter who wasn't named initially. And so it said that a slender gentleman appeared at an elegant soiree, and he passed a cup to a young woman, and the group was shocked because he admired the smile of a beautiful woman, and she said coyly, "They're all false," and the crowd was shocked, and she took a cup like a teacup, and her pearly teeth clattered into it as it passed around the gathering, and then it came to this slender young man, and he, according to the newspaper account, he dumped the contents of the cup into his hand, made a gesture, they were gone, she opened her mouth, and there were her teeth again. It's like, whoa. And then the tagline was, of course, this was Madame Hofstetter. It's like, oh, okay, that explains it. So that was a fun anecdote to tell that no one had heard because it's pretty obscure. And that afternoon then, Jay Marshall was introducing someone, and, you know, he gets up and he he opens his mouth and he had his teeth all blacked out, you know, as a reference to that anecdote. And I was great. I was in heaven, walking on clouds. It was a super thing. And that stimulated, you know, Walter had ads for the book and took pre-orders and stuff. And there was a regular edition and a deluxe edition. I think the regular was $39.95 and the deluxe was leather bound was $79.95. And there was a translation that Walter Graham published. That it was actually the book that I translated was written or compiled, as how he put it, by Ottokar Fischer. A lot of people know him from his Illustrated mm-hmm. Magic. He was an Austrian magician and scholar of magic, collector of magic, good friend of Houdini's. And he dedicated his life to trying to preserve the repertoire and reputation of this great 19th century magician who he never knew. Hofstetter died in 1875, and I think Fischer was born in 1872 or something. Right. But he became fascinated by this guy who almost had become forgotten, partly because he was so secretive.
Like Edward G. Brown.
Yeah, very similar. Yep. And Edward G. Brown does a Hofstetter trick at Everywhere and Nowhere is one in his book that's now available again from Vanishing Ink.
And I think that was kind of interesting that Andy was talking about how that he was one who inspired Vernon. And that I had moved to Omaha from Midland. Yeah. And well, now that I think about that, I believe actually that we first met.
I don't met at one of Charlie McFarlane's.
I was going to say Charlie McFarlane's where we had the Close Up for Connoisseurs. Yeah. He had one in Midland and one in Dallas.
I didn't go to the Midland one. I did go to the one in Dallas.
Okay, then we didn't meet because I did not go to the Dallas. Oh, okay. Of course, I live in Midland, and that first one, that was really awesome. That had Martin Nash and Heba Habba Al and Roger Klaus and Daryl and Michael Amar and
those were great conventions. Yeah. Really good talent lineup. Yeah.
And anyhow, spoiled. That we did. That was a great convention. They had the second one, I think, after that. It's kind of like, okay, I think we've lost enough money. That's fine. Let's move on.
Yeah, they learned their lesson.
But when I moved to Omaha, I don't remember how it was I got hooked up, or maybe that you had said that you should meet Walter Graham, and I did, and then I got the book from him up there. I don't know how, he said you should meet Dick. That was
when
how
he
was.
Knew you were going to Houston, maybe.
Yes.
Because he knew I just moved there.
Right. Yeah, that was what it was.
I think it came out. I think we moved to Houston. We did. We moved to Rosemary, my wife and I, she's a violinist. We moved to Houston in 85, which is the summer it came out. So that kind of put me on the magic history map. It was my little claim to fame at the time. And that was the year that summer we moved to Houston. And you probably got there within a year or two after that.
I moved there in 87.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. 2 years later.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And then we started working the Magic Island together back when.
Yeah.
Since we alluded to that story about the Magic Island, there was you and me and Charlie McFarlane and Bill Palmer. And I think Banachek was there. We still Steve Shaw.
Yeah.
And what were we being paid back then? $50 an hour or something? Or, I mean,
it was
for the
a night.
Yeah, $75,
$100. Maybe.
It wasn't $100. I think you were the one that got us to $100.
Okay,
because you said we're getting out of here. I think that was the reason.
Am I the bad guy in this story?
You said I'm leaving. You leaving? What about you? Yeah, I'm leaving. Okay. Well, how about you? Okay.
Now my recollection is, and I don't know, it's kind of vague back there, but something. One of the managers, I might have been David Ahmed, the owner, co-owner at the time. Someone chewed out two of our buddies, and I'm going to say it was Charlie and Steve Banachek, and they were out of there. And my thing was, now this may have been a later one, because I never physically walked out of the club, but I think I was in Utah, and they got, there was an incident where they walked out. They just had it. And so I was back in Utah and got a call about this happening, and I resolved kind of not to cross the picket line. You know, I was going to, this was the Magician's Union. I wasn't going to be a scab. And so I told Scott Hollingworth, who was the entertainment director at the time, that I was not going to come back or something. Right. And I think he brought in some other good people in. Kurt Miller started then.
Yes, that's right. That's others. Right. Yeah, I think Jamie Salinas came in about that time.
But there were a bunch of problems. Some of them were, you know, if we'd get canceled. I'd be getting my tuxedo on a Friday night, and he'd say, hey, Roger's in town. And it's like, don't come in. It's like, well, I'm, you know.
Yeah.
I'd made plans and things like that. That was not good.
Yeah. No, I understand. So anyhow, it was a little bit later that you got going with H&R, because I remember at one of our magic meetings that Charlie Randall was saying, hey, you know, that there's a new book coming out, and if you're interested, you know, I can get a better deal.
He and I were buying every new book that came out, and I think so was Frank Price and a couple other guys, and we figured to get a 40% discount, the wholesale price, you had to buy three copies. Well, there's two of us right there. All we need is a third guy.
Right.
And
right.
So we kind of would count heads. Who wants this new Kaufman book that's coming out? Mm-hmm. Because we're getting ready to order them. And that set up a wholesale account with probably D. Robbins might have been our first account. And then eventually other companies came out that we'd have accounts with to get the books. And at some point in there, so that was just a little, that was not a money-making thing. We just, everybody got the book at cost, and we split it up.
I just remember that, you know, whenever you would come to the meeting, you'd have a box of books that you'd say, hey, last month you guys ordered this, and I got them in and,
right,
and collect, and it was just, cost, and it's like we all got a good deal.
Yeah.
And then you started realizing, you know, there might be some opportunity.
Well, I think we were losing some money because there was always shipping and stuff that we hadn't kind of figured into it. But the big change came when Wayne Reike, do you remember Wayne?
Of course.
He decided to sell his library, which was substantial. It was a really good, you know, not just a working library. It was a collector's library that
kind
had
like
some
yours.
Interesting stuff. Yeah.
When you got rid of yours.
We made him, Charlie and I, neither of us was interested or probably able to buy it as individuals, but we both went in there and looked at it, and together we said, well, here's, you know, we had a list of the books that were there that he'd somehow generated from his computer. And so we went through and added it up and did the numbers and figured what we could afford to pay for it. And we, made him an offer, which he rejected. That was not, I think he was trying to finance, he was handicapped, as you recall, and he was trying to finance a way to lift his wheelchair into his van, you know, something that there was something that motivated his desire to sell his library. So what he ended up doing, which makes perfect sense, is having people come in and cherry pick it. You know, so people would say, I want this one, I want that one, and he'd put prices on them, and they'd sell them whatever his prices were. And Charlie and I did that as well, because there were books that we wanted for ourselves, not just to resell. So everybody went in and got the books they wanted at the prices that he set on them, and then that still left a substantial number left over. So at that point, he came back to us. Well, we'd already gotten the books we wanted, so now we're looking buy it to resell it because we got the stuff we wanted.
Right.
So we made it another offer, which was lower because we'd gotten the good stuff and everybody else had too. But he accepted that one. But that left us with a ton of books that neither of us wanted. I mean, there were still a few, obviously, we did. Not the priority ones. And so that generated our first H&R Magic list, which we probably only printed out probably less than 100 copies, and we took them to a TOM. We had the books in boxes in our room. You know, we didn't have a dealer booth. We weren't dealers. At least we didn't think of ourselves that way.
Right.
And we just said, hey, you know, we've got these books in the room. If you want to take a look, and here's a list. And
people came in.
Yeah, and we didn't sell them all there, but over time we got rid of that inventory.
Right.
And so at that time, Genie had a classified section, free classified ads, and people would occasionally put in, hey, I'm selling my library or my husband's library or whatever, and we'd send for the list and make them an offer. And so we had another library, a guy named Levitt. I think we had been a funeral director in Iowa, and that was a pretty good collection. And again, we always kept a few things for ourselves that we wanted, and then we'd sell the rest, kind of pay for the ones we kept. And so that each list would have a substantial used book section. And then up front, new books that we had either just gotten or were getting and we'd write up little kind of reviews of them. And those lists were very successful. I don't know how many we went through. This was all pre-internet. We didn't have a website. And, so the list would go out and it would start hitting across the country more or less at the same time. And I'd be on the phone for like 48 hours just writing down numbers from the orders that they were taking. Then it would take us a couple of weeks to dig out from under those orders to pack and ship them. The really big change with H&R came when
Mickey Hades
decided to go out of business, close his Seattle Magic Center. And we weren't interested in being magic store owners. We didn't want to move to Seattle and buy it. And he had non-book inventory. He had videotapes and he had instruction sheets and he had probably props and stuff. And we were only interested in the books. But he had, and that was the core of his business, though. His business model was never lose a sale by not having something in stock. If it was new, he didn't deal.
He had one off of everything, or one.
He had multiple copies. Yeah.
He had just-in-time inventory, kind of a.
No,
thing.
that's we wish.
Oh, okay.
So he kept. Now, a lot of that were Hades publications, which, you know, he got at cost because he published them, and they were mostly spiral-bound things. But he had so we ended up cutting a deal with him.
He was probably back then competing with Magic, Inc., you know. And
they had a similar thing, probably. Yeah, exactly. And again, their own publications. But so he had any publication that was Magic-related that he could get, he had copies of in his inventory. And, you know, that's a great business model. When you're in business, it's not so great when you're trying to go out of business. Because no one can swallow it. And you have a lot of stuff that is not that liquid. But it was great for us to get started. And it changed. Until that time, I was dealing out of my home. We had a shelf of books, mostly used books, and a small shelf of new books. And, you know, that was all we needed was that one, you know, 6-foot shelf of six shelves. But a truck was coming to us from Seattle that had 142 boxes in it that were some kind of box to PEX. Not
you'd
peanuts,
actually, I assume, gone up there to take a look at the...
No.
Oh, you
no,
never did?
No, but we had a list of each title and how many he had. Mm-hmm. And so the truck was on its way, and we had to scramble to get warehouse space, which we did, and unloaded them. And for 6 months to a year, I think we did business out of that warehouse space, which was not air conditioned or anything.
I remember
kind of
that.
Awkward. Yeah.
I got a picture of you somewhere, you and... You and Dick, yeah.
And the problem with it was, one problem with it was that Mickey Hades had organized it all by alphabetically by title, not by
author
or subject matter. So Al Mann, he had a lot of Al Mann titles, but they were in 40 different boxes because they all had different alphabetical titles.
Interesting.
And same with Louis Ganson. Tons of Louis Ganson titles, but they were scattered all over. So it
That's
was awkward.
That's kind of like saying, okay, here are my pink books, and these are the green books.
Right.
Here are my yellow books.
Yeah, but they're all mixed up in a kind of a rainbow of different boxes.
Right.
So the next big change came when we actually moved out of that warehouse into space that we rented. It was over a tennis shop, and our landlord owned the tennis shop. It was in Humble, Texas, the town I was living in, which Charlie was south of town. I was north of town in a suburb of Houston. And so we'd kind of meet in the middle, or I'd go down to his place, or he'd come up to my place. But we hired staff to pack and ship and inventory. And we totally, at that point, things came out of the boxes, went on the shelves. A friend of ours, a friend of yours too, Joe Anderson, built us wonderful mm-hmm. bookshelves that we put everything on. Wonderful carpenter, great craftsman. And
you also used to host lectures up there.
We did occasionally. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. We did have...
Bill Goldman, John Carney, and John
David
Pendragon.
Now, Pendragon came to our next location. He was
right,
the second
floor. That's right,
one,
second
floor,
yep.
We did have a bunch up there. So at some point we moved out. Oh, well, that's another story. I don't know how interesting it is to your readers, but the tennis shop owner decided to sell the property that we were in. And he offered it to us. And I kind of was inclined to think we should buy it, but you know, Charlie did the financials and didn't think it was such a good deal. And the guy that bought it to run a gambling operation downstairs. Yeah. Do you remember this?
I do remember that.
I don't remember his name. He eventually went to jail.
Yeah.
But there was one scary lecture. I don't know if I remember who that was. We were having a lecture up there, and we started to smell like gasoline in the hallways, and I called the landlord who was running this gambling operation saying, hey, there's something going on. And Charlie and I later decided that he was planning to torch the place for the insurance money because he'd done that. He'd flooded a bunch of his properties and then got the insurance money. And I can't remember if that's why he went to jail or because of the gambling thing. He had found some loophole in Texas law where you could have – it was a slot machine operation. And as long as the payoff was not in cash, so people would win Walmart coupons or Kmart coupons or something
that.
Like that. You know, so but they were gambling. You know, they just weren't getting payoffs in cash. But they could apparently take them to those stores and get cash for them or something.
Yeah.
I can't remember the deal. But it was just a loophole in the Texas law that he was exploiting. And then they came down on him. But at some point there so it was in receivership in the courts, and the guy that ended up buying it, being our landlord for a while, was the guy who had been put in charge of selling it. It's like, that seems like a conflict of interest.
Yeah.
You know, we would have been interested in buying it. How
sure.
come this? Anyway, at some point in there, we moved into our later and final location in Humble, which was much better because that one we were on the second floor, and those books are heavy.
I was about to say, it was your new one, you were on the ground level, but that other one, I was thinking every time you go to these conventions and you're lugging those boxes.
Yeah,
we
come home saying, boy, we're going into the balloon and silk business next. This book thing is, we're getting hernias.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to Andy Gregg at, and that
he's got it down to a system, but still.
Yeah, but he drives everywhere. Of course,
he's got a van.
He's got a van and he's driving across the country, you know, and he looks at this very closely in dollars and cents and how much he's going to make and how many people are attending.
It's a serious business for him. And he's got it figured out, I think, you know, the more inventory he brings, he'll sell a certain percentage of his inventory.
Yeah.
So the more inventory he brings, he's going to sell that same percentage. The more he brings, the better he does. So he brings a lot.
Do you think there are fewer books being published today?
Boy, that seems like – I was surprised at this convention, the Magi Fest, how many new books there were that came out right here that were not on my radar screen. There's a new, and I'm excited about them all, the brand new, well, the one that was hot here, obviously, because Tom Reese was here as a special guest, is his latest book, The Magic Rainbow, which people have been waiting a long time for. Very substantial book. I'm going to guess maybe 500 pages. It looks really, I haven't taken one out of the shrink wrap and looked at it, but it looks substantial. And a you know, price tag on it accordingly. But it, they shipped 100 copies here, not to us. It's a Hermetic press, and Hermetic is now owned by Penguin. And so Penguin had them at their booth.
Oh, Steve Minch sold that? I thought that was his, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was his. Yeah. He started that and built up the fabulous reputation. I would say they are the premier magic publishers of books, quality books. And, you know, there's not a, they haven't put out a bad title yet.
Right.
And they do them right. But he decided to draw back. He's not retired. He's still very active, but not running, you know, not doing the packing and shipping and running the business. So he sold that business to Penguin. So they now have all the publishing rights and are the publishers of all the Hermetic titles. They've kept the Hermetic brand, so they're not Penguin titles. They're Hermetic titles, but
they're
still
under that
own
name
and run it.
Gotcha.
So they got 100 of them. They thought about maybe only taking 50. They got 100, and I think they were gone within an hour.
Oh, they were. They were.
Yeah.
Yeah. The line
evaporated.
Was, yeah. Well, you're looking over 1,000 people at the convention.
Yeah.
And so, and Tamara's here to sign the thing, and how
this
rare
is
that? You know, it's like sighting a rainbow or a unicorn, you know.
Yeah.
And speaking of the rainbow.
So that's brand new. At, the Magic Rainbow. The other new book that I was excited to see because I hadn't known it was coming out is by Stephen Minch, also Hermetic title, and I don't remember the title of it, but it's Giacomo Bertini's coin work, and I've seen him at 4F. He's fabulous. I mean, he will. He's so kind of a lateral thinker that it's just I'm gonna buy the book to find out how he does that stuff. I may not be able to do it. I don't know. I don't know that it's knuckle busting. It probably isn't, but it's so different that. I think it's really innovative, so I'm excited about that. But there, then when we come to a convention like this, Charlie orders books to be shipped to us that are the latest titles, titles that people are not likely to have seen at prior conventions because, you know, we want the latest and the greatest. Because we're not our business model with H&R was to have both new and used, and like Mickey Hades, not lose the sale by not having something in stock. And so... We would, and when we could drive to conventions, we would have both new and used.
I remember you also used to pick up the lecture notes. You know, like a lot of times, magicians who are lecturing and have notes left over, and you'd pick them up or their books.
Yeah,
or
we'd love having stuff that was hard to find, and we'd
so
import
stuff. So
sometimes
you came back with more stuff than you brought.
That's true. That's a problem, but we would do that. And things from England and Carl Fulvey's titles, which are hard to get, and just obscure stuff. We'd like to. The idea being that if someone thinks, "Hey, I'm looking for a book. Where should I check?" Well, they'd think of us first because odds are we'd have it. And
I'm going to ask you about Carl Fulvey in just a moment because he's an interesting guy.
He is very interesting,
and fascinating. And I want, but before we do, and I want to kind of wrap up about H&R. As far as I know, people are thinking, "Well, H&R closed, and the Marshall Peterson is running that." Well,
yeah,
I say closed. I mean, that you had sold it. So what's the transition? Because people still
complex.
See you, not Marshall. So So people are thinking, "Wait a minute, this is H&R. I sold it. What's the deal?" And
I like to think of myself as the celebrity spokesperson. So Marshall will.
And Charlie's the one who carries your bags.
He's
not.
He slaps stuff around. So I'm the H. He's the R. And we like hanging out in the booth. We like, you know, we weren't in the business to make money. Obviously, we didn't want to lose money. We wanted to make money.
Sure.
But it was a hobby business that kind of grew unexpectedly, to especially once the website got started. Mm-hmm. It really exploded. And we pioneered, I think, in that field. Now, a lot of, I would say Vanishing Ink has done a great job in a lot. They publish books. They sell all the good books. They curate their inventory. So they're not carrying everything. They're only carrying stuff they think is worthwhile.
Yeah.
We were trying to carry everything. You know, we carry bad books and good books. And, and they, like you said, you know, if we were at a lecture and he had notes left over, we would try and get a deal to have them for our customers. Because that was our goal, have some of everything. But as I said, that's a great model when you're in a business to not lose the sales, but when you're trying to go out of business, then who can swallow that mountain of inventory?
Right.
A lot of which you may have had, you know, some of the Hades titles, you probably had them since he opened that shop in Seattle, and you know, so they were not the newest, latest thing.
But he had it in stock.
Yeah.
So, again, you guys go there because I know Marshall's got another full-time job and a family.
Right. So Marshall does
have
a serious full-time
shop.
Job.
He has things in his garage.
You can go. You can buy appointment. You can go visit
go
his stuff. And I haven't been there. He's moved since I moved. And so I don't know. I'm guessing it's not in a garage. I think he has a warehouse. I think it's a separate structure.
Climate control
not built
warehouse.
For that.
Yeah.
But, built out for it.
Because a lot of times people would come to Houston. That I know yours wasn't a typical magic shop nor a bookstore necessarily, but people still came and hung out and visited.
Right. Now,
and
we loved
they've
that.
Asked me, said, well, where are they now? And I said, well, Beaumont, plus it's really not a shop per se.
Right.
You know,
and you'd have to, you know, make an appointment because he has a day
for.
Job.
You just can't go browsing like we did at your place.
Right. It is different in that regard. Yeah. Yeah. But Marshall's still, I mean, it's still a viable business. The website he keeps up. He say, if you're not on his mailing list, you should be. He sends out newsletters much more often than we did. At some point, and I kind of regret it, we stopped doing the physical hard copy lists. And the reason I say I regret it is until then, we'd send out a list. I'd get the calls over, you know, 48 hours, take down those orders nonstop, and then start to fill them. But it had, you know, at the end of that period, our shelves would be empty. You know, we'd have sold all those used books, more or less. They didn't stick around long. When we stopped doing those physical lists, we would put the used titles on the website, but that's not as it's effective. If people are looking for something, they'll find it there. But when you got those hard copy lists, you would read it, and you'd find books you didn't know you wanted, you know, and it was it was expensive because we'd have to print them, we'd have to pay the postage on them, we'd have to maintain a mailing list, so it was a bunch of work that we didn't have to do once we did the website. But I don't think the website is as effective for selling the used titles. They're listed there, but they just kind of sit there.
Right, and that's magicbookshop.com.
It's the same website, magicbookshop.com, and it's a good website, and he's upgraded it. It's a better website than it was when he had it, and you can get, since I left the company, you know, the downloads, you can download videos and buy ebooks there instantly, which is a whole new technology that we didn't have to deal with.
Okay. So in talking about Carl Fulvis, Hall Youngblood had given a talk on the TAOM about that one time, and I didn't know that that was such an interesting guy that he's still living in the 1970s, I guess, as far as what he is editing, and he doesn't have a phone. You have to call his neighbor, and they go next door and tell him.
Yeah, you can't. That was one of the problems in stocking his stuff. We love his books, so we love stocking him. We're one of the few dealers, maybe the only dealer. Well, that's probably not true. Andy Gregret might have had his new books too, but yeah, it was all, you'd have to do it through snail mail. You'd say,
and you'd have to have a self-addressed stamped envelope.
So you'd say, we see that you've got this new title out. We'd like a dozen copies.
Yeah.
And then we'd put it in the mail and send that request to him. Then he'd send a back of things saying, okay, 12 copies with shipping would be this amount. And we'd have to write a check, put it in the envelope, send it back. And it would take months, sometimes longer, because he had a home in New Jersey, but he also had a home in Florida. And if we sent it to New Jersey, did we have to wait till he got back
home
from Florida?
Yeah.
It was all P.O. boxes. I talked to him once or twice on the phone, but I could never call him. I, you know, didn't have access to a number for him.
Right.
He could call us. And, you know, it was just unusual. He's an eccentric and kind of reclusive. I know people who have met him and who have known him, you know, physically. He exists.
Yes.
But, you know, by choice, he just is does his own thing. And but so, you know, influential, I think. As a prolific writer of stuff that's had an impact on a certain segment of the, you know, community, he's really.
How many titles do you think he's drafted?
Gosh, you know, ignoring all the general public stuff, you know, all the Dover titles.
That's true.
All those, that whole self-working series, and a bunch of stuff just for magicians that he's self-published. Hull would be the guy to ask because he did a good bibliography at one time.
The
bibliography was
on
probably 24 pages of titles, I'm guessing. You know, it was a serious little monograph.
It was.
And
that was Hull Youngblood, who is out of Austin. San Antonio, I think, actually.
He is out of Austin.
He moved over to San Antonio,
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because he had a practice in Austin, but then he moved over to San Antonio.
Then he also put out a bunch of interesting magazines, starting with Paul Bear's Review, I guess. Well, he took over the last few issues of New Phoenix, and then morphed that into the Paul Bear's Review.
Which was an interesting story, by the way, about why it's called the Paul Bearers. Because he thought he was going to die, and so he asked all of his friends to submit these articles and these tricks, thinking they would carry him to his grave.
Oh, I didn't
know
that.
Had you heard that?
I did not know that. That's probably in Hull's talk.
Yeah, okay.
I didn't remember that. And I know there's no apostrophe, you know, is it Paul Bear's apostrophe S or Paul Bear's S apostrophe? And it is neither. So it's either day or die.
Richard,
Yeah. On the Dick Richard thing, my friends call me Dick, or most of them. Charlie, I think, still calls me Richard. People that met me in Texas tend to call me Richard. My in-laws call me Richard. Just, you know, there's a certain stigma with the nickname, I guess, that they can't bring themselves to use. But, what's the gentleman, Tom Ladchuk came up for a title for a video, the only video that I've done, which Joel Ray was at an IBM convention filming Friends, and it was kind of a series, Joel Ray and Friends. I don't know how far it got along, but I was one of his friends and went to his, you know, hotel room and talked, kind of like we're talking now, except for a video camera. Right. And his friend Tom Ladshaw, a very funny guy.
Ventriloquist.
Yeah, he's very active in the Vent Haven. I moved out there to help be one of the curators there, but a very talented magician and ventriloquist, but his I think primary love is ventriloquism. The title he came up for the video featuring me as Joel Ray's friend was Magicians Don't Know Dick. It's like, oh man. I thought it was funny, but I'm kind of
well,
glad like, that kind of disappeared.
Like with Steve Shaw, a lot of people knew him as Steve, and some people don't know what his original name was.
Sure.
And so they asked me, I mean, being my best friend and partner since 1987, that I call him Banachek. It's funny. You know, my wife always still called him Steve.
Most
and people who have known him way back when still, he responds to either thing, obviously.
Right.
But I think I asked him once. He said, well, I prefer Banachek. And so that's what I always call him, just in conversation.
Sure.
If, to me, it sounds funny to call him Steve anymore because I'm so used to calling
him
Banachek.
You're used to that other transition. Yeah.
Which when he came up with that name, that he was thinking of different things he was going to be. He said, Scott, I'm getting ready to go in a different direction. And he said, I've got this name. What do you think of this? And Banachek, I said, that won't work. That'll never work.
Oh, really?
Yeah. What do I know?
To my recollection, I don't know how he got it. Obviously, there was the TV show. But I think what the appeal, part of the appeal was the rhythm of it.
Correct.
Like Anneman, Dunninger, Banachek. You know, it fit that model.
That told him that same
and
thing.
And he's in that mold, you know, so it's a perfect fit. I think it worked out well for him. It's made it his own.
We're going to take a quick break now to hear from our sponsor, Greg Moreland, talking about the Portland Magic Jam. So with me right now, I've got Greg Moreland, who is in charge of the Portland Magic Jam, and want to talk a little bit about that's going to be coming up not too far from now, March 22nd through the 24th. And how are you doing, first of all, Greg?
Very good, and that is indeed the date. This will be the 10th year.
The 10th year.
Portland Magic Jam was started in 2009.
And it looks like from your website that you've had just a ton of really top-notch talent coming to Portland.
In the past, of course, we've had Daryl, Aaron Fisher, Nate Kranzo, Danny Garcia, Greg Wilson, John Armstrong, Simon Lovell, Garrett Thomas, Cosmo, Michael Lamar, Chad Long, Paul Draper. Last year we had Aussie Wind, Banachek, Michael Finney, and Tony Clark. We've had a lot of people over the years.
Wow.
I don't know how we talk them into coming. It's a humble convention. We get about 150 magicians from Oregon and Washington, and we got about a dozen people fly in to see it, but it's mostly local.
I'm surprised you don't have more people who come down from Canada.
You know, they have an event up in Canada. It's a smaller event. I don't think we have many. A whole lot of people come down from Canada.
Well, hopefully after they hear this podcast and they realize some of the talent you got coming up this year that might attract them. So tell me, who have you got coming up?
This year is the second time we've repeated anyone, and we're having David Regal back. He was at the first one 10 years ago. We got Jonathan Levitt, we got Tom Burgoon, and we got Robert Ramirez.
I love all those guys, and it's a good reason why you're having David come back, because I'm sure that he was popular. I hear people asking me all the time, you know, when's David going to be available to lecture, or, you know, he doesn't really go to a lot of conventions. That's really great. And I remember Robert Ramirez really hitting it out of the park with his performance and stuff he was selling at Magic Live last year. And I love Jonathan Levitt. He was on a podcast with me here just a few months ago. And Tom Burgoon's one of the funniest guys on stage. You know, David Sandy, a friend of mine there in Kansas City, says that Tom Burgoon's one of his favorite magicians in the world. And Tom is just awesome. You got a great lineup coming up. And so it's going to be in Portland, Oregon, up in the Northwest. Tell me about is it all going to be taking place in a hotel?
Yeah, it's at the Airport Sheraton. Everything takes place under the same roof. We have our function room. We got a dealer's room, kind of a smaller dealer's room. We got the lectures there. We've got a close-up round robin where we put all the attendees go into one of four rooms. So we got like 40 people around the table in each room. The headliners go around, all four of them. They rotate around and do 15 to 20 minute sets. So you sit down. If you're one of the 40 in room A, say, you sit down and the guys just line up and one after the other do a close-up set.
That sounds great. And then do you have evening shows then as well?
Big
we have
shows.
Evening shows on Friday and Saturday. We have a panel discussion on Sunday. Of course, all four of them do a lecture, one on Friday, three on Saturday. Then we have a grab bag lecture on Sunday where everybody does a little bit. A lot of stuff. I keep the headliners really busy.
Boy, it sounds like you really do. And I notice also you have contests as well, that stage and close-up contest for seniors and youth, or are they all in one category?
It's just I really can't fit in more than one contest. If I could fit in more, I could. The contest is, what do we call it, parlor magic that mm-hmm. happens up in the air. Nothing happens down on a table. I mean, they can use a table, but it can't be something, it's got to play to – I don't know, on Sunday there might be 100 people there, maybe 75 people there. And there's a big old trophy, like a 2.5 foot big old gold trophy.
Wow. And when people want to enter the contest, can they enter before the convention? So this way they sign up? Or do they
yes,
sign
they
up
can. And, okay. and it's on the events tab at portlandmagicjam.com.
Okay. And it's called Magic Jam because I understand you have jam sessions also.
That was the original vision. That was the original vision. We have tables. So, listen, I was good friends with Jerry Andrus. Jerry, in the 10 years before he passed away, he couldn't drive at night. So whenever I was in town, I would drive Jerry to whatever magic meeting was happening in Eugene, was happening in Portland. And Jerry always said, the thing about conventions, they just don't have a room where people can sit down and – and he didn't use the word jam, session. I think the word mm-hmm. session. And I told him at the time, and I had no intention of putting a convention together. I said, Jerry, I'll tell you what. If I ever run a convention, I'm going to have a room just for sessioning. And I ended up putting a convention together and going, I told that to Jerry, and it's a really good idea. So we call it the Jerry Andrus Session Room.
That's cool. Yeah, I know that's very successful in other conventions. I know Magic Live has a separate room that's over to the side that is always full. Seems like day and night, with people sitting there at the round tables and everything then, too.
Exactly.
So what is the cost of this?
It's a sliding cost. It starts early registration, $120. Then it goes up like $10 every month, and the door is $150. I could really charge double that for this. People keep saying, hey, how come you're not charging $250? I'm kind of like Costco. I keep it as low as I can.
That's right. Sell in bulk and good quality.
Yeah, and that includes everything. And of course, not your hotel rooms. They get a deal at the Sheraton.
Yeah.
And there's a link on the website. And by the way, all this info is at portlandmagicjam.com or pdxmagicjam.com.
Okay. Now, again, this has been going on for 10 years, and already that what the dates are going to be for 2020, right?
Yeah, we actually have the 2020 dates. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. It's March 27 through 29, the year 2020. Don't know anything about the headliners, of course. We got some big ones that are tentatively scheduled that have expressed interest. They said, yeah, but I'm not going to mention any of them because I don't want to disappoint
anyone.
Sure,
it's going to be in the same location, I guess, there at that airport hotel.
Same location, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, and then probably the same website, then go to pdxmagicjam.com.
Absolutely. We've had this website for 10 years.
Okay, awesome. So if this is running too close to the time when you're listening to this, all of you listeners out there, and you're not going to be able to make it, that you're going to have a year to make plans for next March.
Can go on the website and sign up for the announcement list. I don't send out many announcements, but when we know about headliners for future, so if they sign up for the announcement list, they'll hear about the next and the next one, and I don't send more than like 5 emails a year about the event. So you're not going to get bombarded.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, sounds like a lot of fun. Greg, thanks very much for the details on that. And everybody go check out the Portland Magic Jam.
Thank you for talking with me, Scott.
And now back to the second half of part one of our discussion with Richard Hatch.
I wanted to then ultimately still get over to Erdnase, because I know there's the Erdnase project. There's a movie, and they've got a Kickstarter campaign going, trying to raise some money. The fellow that's producing this, he's spoken to you. I know already. You've done several scholarly talks, and what's the name of the Magic, Jason.
Jason England.
England had talked about that at Magic Live.
Yeah, that was fun. Yeah.
And he had brought with him a lot of editions.
He's got an unbelievable collection of just different printings. And
So what's going on? What's the newest? Or what do you know? Or, or do you want to talk a little bit about what your philosophy was and how it's evolved to who you think he was?
Sure. I have my favorites. I kind of like all the candidates, and am interested in all the theories. I have my favorites, but I don't have. I can't say this is who it was definitively. Case closed. And some people that have worked on it say that about their candidates.
One quick thing, as people are starting to say, who are they talking about?
Yes, sure.
We're talking about Erdene Ace, who wrote...
Okay, so we're talking about there was a book that came out in 1902 in Chicago that originally was entitled Artifice, Ruse, and Subterfuge at the Card Table. When I say originally, that was on the title page, and that turns out to be the copyrighted title, or the title that it was copyrighted under in 1902.
Rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, but the title that was printed on the front cover and on the spine was The Expert at the Card Table, and that's what it's generally known as now and is on most of the title pages of the later printings rather than The Artifice, Ruse, and Subterfuge, which
and the
is
a mouthful.
Well, the author gave his name as S.W. Erdene Ace, and that was accepted at the time. Why not? That's, could be... whoever wrote it. There are a lot of immigrants to the U.S., a lot of unusual, Polish names and foreign, could be. Why not? But at some point, people got curious, who is this guy? Because they fell in love with the book. Vernon was the big champion of it. It was his Bible, and he'd fool people, and they'd say, where's that? Oh, it's in Erdene Ace. And so he was a big reason why it's so beloved now, because it was so beloved by him.
Yeah, right.
He had it memorized and, could quote passages from it. From
and of course,
memory.
He even has a book, The Annotated.
He eventually had his own version of it, right, his commentary. So people became interested, who is this guy? And fairly early on, some people, not everybody, I wouldn't have probably spotted this because I don't think that way, but like Martin Gardner, an early scholar in researching it, he says that as a teenager, when he first encountered the book, he recognized that if you read S.W. Erdene Ace backwards from the other end, it spells out a plausible real name, which is E.S. Andrews. So the theory that many people held to for a long time was that it was a pseudonym and the author's real name was E.S. Andrews. We didn't know who that was, but people began to look for Andrews who might have written it, including and the really heavy lifting early work was an important work was done by Martin Gardner, who was in Chicago where the book had been published, and he had local resources he could track down. And his big first breakthrough came from he tracked down the illustrator of the book, a guy named Marshall D. Smith. And on the title page, his name is given with over 100 illustrations from life by M. D. Smith. And he looked in the Chicago phone book, found an illustrator, Marshall D. Smith, and said, I wonder if that's the guy. I wrote him a letter. This was in December 1946, I think. Working from memory here, but I think that's right. And he got a letter back right away. Say, yeah, I did the illustrations for that book. What do you want to know?
Wow.
And he made a beeline over to the guy, called him up and said, I'm coming, and took his notebook and interviewed him extensive, got a good physical description, asked him what the man's real name was. The man, Smith, says he'd never seen a copy of the book until Gardner brought him one. And there's some confusing things about it. When he saw the book, he said, he didn't recognize the name S.W. Erdene Ace. And he said, I thought it was a name with a W in it. Well, S.W. Erdene Ace has a W, so he must be indicating he thought the last name had a W in it.
Some people go by their middle name.
Right. So that was confusing. Gardner, in his enthusiasm, in hindsight, it's like, oh, I wish he hadn't done that. But in enthusiasm, he says to Smith, well, could his name have been Andrews? And Smith responds quite enthusiastically, saying, oh, it was, I do remember, it was a Mr. Andrews. I don't remember if his initials were ES or whatever. I don't remember that, but it was definitely a Mr. Andrews. And for the rest of their interaction, they refer to him as Mr. Andrews. Mr. Andrews is Mr. Andrews. That. Well, the problem is, that could be it was a prompted recollection.
Correct.
It wasn't something he said, well, let me think about it. I think it was Andrews, if you maybe could have given him a list of names,
question.
Pick one out, like a police lineup, which of these looks good. But a lot of that is, hindsight. We're grateful that he got anything. But you have fairly strong confirmation.
The guy's an illustrator. He should have drawn a picture of what the guy looked like.
Well, Gardner had him do a sketch.
Not
a composite. It's not that he did a picture. He did a cartoon for Gardner of a man manipulating cards. It's not intended to be the man he met. unfortunately. Yeah, but yeah, that's another thing. Yeah, he saw the man. Let's do a police sketch and track him down. But he did give him a good physical description, and he said he was...
Was he from Chicago, just passing through?
No, he says he had the impression that he was not from Chicago. They met in an unheated hotel room. It was quite cold. The illustrator, kept his coat on, and he remembered the location of the hotel. He didn't remember its name, but he said it was on this street. He thought it was on such and such corner, maybe even the southeast corner or something. He had a very strong recollection of where it was and meeting him. And he said he was probably about 5'6", and that he was between 40 and 45 years old. And now some of this, you have to figure out, well, it's all relative. You know, is he remembering a man who's older than he is or younger than he is when he says he's between 40 and 45? Well, it turns out the illustrator now we don't know exactly when this was done. The book came out in March of 1902, so it had to be done before that, but could have been done 10 years before it. We don't really know. Mm-hmm. Our assumption it was done fairly shortly before the book was published. So, in fact, a very clever guy who's sadly since passed away, David Alexander, who did a lot of really interesting, who had a background as a detective among many other careers that he had, as well as a stage pickpocket and magician, protege of Fraxon, a really fascinating guy and smart guy. He went back and said, well, it was an extremely cold day by Chicago standards. Smith was living in Chicago and he thought it was cold. So he goes back and looks at the National Weather Bureau records and he pinpointed a day in December 1901. That's the day they met because that was there was a cold snap. It was mild, 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 and then it was really cold and then it was mild, mild, mild. So that's when they must have met in the hotel. I think that's really interesting. I don't know if I believe it, but I would never have even thought to do that. And it takes a different kind of thinking. So so using the information that he got from Smith as a guide, Gardner started to track down Andrews, who might have been the authors, and he'd write to Smith saying, hey, could it be this guy? Could it be that guy? And he didn't find an E.S. Andrews. Now, this is all pre-internet. He's got to do this by looking through phone directories and
across the country,
microfilm newspapers and stuff like that. But at some point, there was a national convention, I'm going to say an SAM convention in Chicago in 1947, and it was organized by the local Chicago SAM assembly to host it, and Gardner was part of that, and he was made the publicity chairman. He thought, hey, let's have Marshall Smith, the illustrator, be one of our guests of honor, and then people can meet him and get their copy signed and that kind of stuff. And Vernon came and got a signed copy of the illustrator's signature on the title page of his copy of the first edition, that kind of stuff. But as a result of that, people found out about Gardner's interest in this mystery. And Walter Gibson, famous magic author and ghostwriter for Thurston and Houdini and Dunninger, Kreskin, many others, he was from Philadelphia, and he said, hey, Martin, there's a guy in Philadelphia who says he knew Erdnase. You should get in touch with him. And it was a gambler named Edgar L. Pratt. And so Gardner writes to Mitch or Michael Cantor, who owned Cantor's Magic Shop in Philadelphia, saying, hey, can you put me in touch with this guy, E.L. Pratt? I'd be interested in this. And Cantor knew him and says, yeah, here's his address. Feel free to contact him. And so they started a written correspondence where Gardner would say, hey, I understand you knew this guy. Was his name E.S. Andrews? And the guy writes back, no, it's the right last name, but it's not the right initials. But he's not forthcoming with information. He's been kind of cagey. Well, eventually Gardner moves to New York and has a chance to go down to Philadelphia and meet him in person and interview him. And he finds out from him at that time that according to Pratt, now this is Pratt claiming this is the guy I knew who apparently wrote the book. Pratt says that the man, his initials are not E.S. He came from a city in the East. He may even have told him it was from Hartford, but I don't think so. But he said he was from the East Coast, which the illustrator also said that he had the impression that the man he met was from the East and just in Chicago to publish this gambling expose. And Smith said he was a card cheat, ex-card cheat who had written this book. But he lets out the information that the man died fairly early, and that it was a tragic death somehow. That Pratt indicates that he really doesn't want to talk about it because it would upset the family, the man's family. That somehow there was a tragedy, and this would
It's too soon.
Yeah, too soon. Well, using that as a clue, Gardner goes to the New York newspaper archives, probably on microfilm even back then, and digs through them, and he finds a front page story. It was like the O.J. Simpson story of its day. There was a murder-suicide in Oakland, California, of a suspected serial killer whose name was Milton Franklin Andrews, who had been a very active cheat, okay. gambler, expert, you know, poker player. But at that time, you know, it was not like poker today. If you were a professional gambler, you were pretty much a cheat. You were an advantage player, let's say.
Okay.
And it wasn't because you knew the statistics, the odds better than everybody else, and were a better strategy.
You knew how to muck cards.
Yeah, you manipulate them. So he starts to pursue this guy who died in this lurid murder-suicide in 1905, and he says, that sure fits the profile. He's a card player. That would explain why he never came forth, because he's clearly the author is proud of his work. Why didn't he ever say, I'm the guy that, you love that book? Love me, sure. I wrote it. There's a certain amount of ego and self-confidence that's expressed through the writing in the book. And so, the book came out in 1902. The guy died in 1905. That explains that. And the copyright expired without being renewed in 1928, I think. And so that would answer a lot of those questions. So Gardner began to investigate this Milton Franklin Andrews. And he writes back to Smith in Chicago, because Gardner is now living in New York, and says, hey, does the name Milton Franklin Andrews mean anything to you? And Smith writes back saying, boy, sounds kind of familiar, but I had a landlord named Franklin, and so, and there was this newspaper case, not Milton Franklin Andrews, but some other one that was a Milton. So maybe I'm confusing it with those. I don't really recognize that name, but it could be. And so he says, if you say the guy was in trouble with the law, is there a police description? Because the guy I met was 5'6" and clean shaven, slim, had the whole physical description there. Maybe that'll help you out. So Gardner, he was being chased by the police at the time. They were apparently knocking on his door when two shots ring out, and they break down the door, and he's murdered his girlfriend, and he's committed suicide himself. And this is the front page story that was so lurid. And so he gets a police wanted kind of poster that has a description, and it says the guy is 6'1.5" in his stocking feet, and he's only like 29. He's the same age as the illustrator, basically, whereas the illustrator clearly recalled a man 10 plus years older than he was. The illustrator in 1901, when we suspect kind of the work was probably done, would have been 29, just a few weeks younger than Milton Franklin Andrews. So there's not a decade's difference. Now, people age at different the life experiences. Sure. They could have had a lot rougher experiences, but still, they're both 29, and to misremember him as...
And the height also.
The height thing is huge. Are you looking up or are you looking down?
Well, he's probably sitting down as he was illustrating.
Yeah, he says,
on the edge of the bed or something.
Well, but he says, I was looking up to this guy, and if he was only five, I would have been looking up to Milton Franklin Andrews, because he's taller than I am, and I was definitely looking down on this guy. Uh-huh. Then he speculates, if he was wanted by the law, maybe I didn't meet the actual author. Maybe he sent a proxy, because and I met his protege that showed me the stuff. But he said, I think I met the guy. And he uses the expression, he seemed to lay his cards on the table, and I think I met the real deal. And if, I didn't meet a 6'1"
Because I'm sure that he was showing him the moves, because he was...
Right, he'd have to, illustrate have to pose
that,
with...
Right, these, with that guy's hands, basically.
And that's another confusing aspect. Some people think it was illustrated from photographs, that you couldn't have sketched it from life, but the title page says Drawn from Life by M.D. Smith, more than one. So, but that's still a controversy. It could have been
traced
from photos.
That was one of the questions
photos.
That Gardner had asked him, if they were done by...
Right, and the illustrator, when he saw the book, had some ambiguous reactions to it. He claimed to not recognize the illustrations, and instead, and this is really kind of strange, he recognized the handwriting under the illustration. So it says Fig, F-I-G, period, Fig 1, Fig 2, up through Fig 101. That's what he recognizes, not the illustration itself.
That's weird.
Pretty strange. And he was also surprised by the number of illustrations in his memory. Now, it's 40 years later when Gardner first meets him, 45 years later.
Yeah, a lot of things going
and
on.
Yeah, and by the time Gardner meets him, he's in his mid-70s, I think, the illustrator. Mm-hmm. And it was clearly not a big project in his life. It was a one or two week.
Yeah, met at the hotel room, hired. He did that,
right,
guy's money,
right.
He went on.
Yeah, it's not clear how many times they met. Obviously, they met an initial time. They met a later time to get, because he said he'd make pencil sketches, he'd get them approved, then he'd go home and ink them in, and then he'd bring them back. And then he got paid by check, and he was hesitant because he didn't know the guy. And what if the check bounces? But it cleared, and he never saw the guy again.
And the checks were signed by Erdnase.
Well, we don't know. We don't know. And he couldn't remember the bank. He thought maybe it was First National in Chicago. That was a big bank, and he remembered it was a big bank. And so Gardner had Jay Marshall go to various Chicago banks and try and look up the bank records.
Okay.
It was kind of a dead end, but they tried all these things.
Okay.
Anyway, where were we on that? So the age and really the height. It's like if we believe the illustrator's recollections and memory is malleable, you know, eyewitness reports are not reliable at all. Four different corners, you get four different events, and
four
just
decades pass also and everything.
Right.
Too.
So, but he's our only eyewitness. So I put a lot of eggs in that basket. And whenever we've been able to check his memory on stuff, it's turned out to be pretty much correct. So there's that in his favor too. So because of that, when I got interested, what got me interested is through the H&R business, Martin Gardner was selling parts of his library. He was living in, I believe, Henderson, North Carolina, and as he was done with stuff, he wasn't a collector, didn't feel a need to keep it around. So he would occasionally send us a box of books, and we'd price them and just kind of sell them on consignment for him, and everybody was happy. And one day I go out to the, had no advance warning of this, I go out to the mailbox, and there's a little beat up brown, you know, little box, and I take it home and open it up, and there's a first edition Erdnase, which I had never seen in person. I had read about. I had by then Jeff Busby put out a book, The Man Who Was Erdnase, really good book. Getting harder to find, but it's by Bart Whaley, Martin Gardner, and Jeff Busby, and it's the whole story of the book and its early history, and then the story of Milton Franklin Andrews, who Gardner had decided this is the guy who wrote it. And he thought that the artist's recollection on that point was just not reliable, that he misremembered. Maybe he, because the guy was so thin, I can't remember the deal, but he had reasons for not believing the artist's recollection once he decided it was Milton Franklin Andrews. And partly, once he decided on Milton Franklin Andrews, then he went back to Pratt in Philadelphia and said, hey, you know, I know now why you were so protective of your friend, because it is a tragic story, but I've spoken to, Gardner tracked down Milton Franklin Andrews' brother, Alvin Andrews, who is still living in Hartford, and interviewed him. He knew nothing about the book. He knew about his brother's gambling activity, and obviously his tragic end, and gave him other points.
Which is why he would have obscured his name, because he was a gambler, and he didn't want that coming back or being associated with him if he's going to still be
The brother was not a gambler.
No, I understand, but I'm talking about Andrews.
Yeah, he did have pseudonyms. I think he would called himself maybe just Milton Franklin at some point, and maybe had one or two other names. None of the names was Erdnase that we have found.
We only use that for the book.
But no one that Gardner tracked down that knew him knew anything about the book. At least initially, that was the claim. But so he goes back to Pratt and says, hey, you know, I talked to his brother. The brother's fine with me writing up like a magazine story about it. So, you know, you don't need to be embarrassed for your friend. You can come clean. And Pratt at that time admitted, okay, you got me. I was talking about Milton Franklin Andrews. But he never claimed a direct relationship with Milton Franklin Andrews. Pratt always claimed, Pratt was from Rhode Island, although he was living in Philadelphia by the time Gardner met him. He had run around in high school in Providence, Rhode Island, with two brothers, and his claim was, and those brothers were apparently card players, and his claim was those two, I'm blanking on their names now, but those two brothers were friends of Milton Franklin Andrews, and Andrews would show them stuff, and they would show Pratt stuff, and then when the book came out, there was the stuff they'd shown him. So that's how he put it together. And then later, E.S. Andrews, he didn't have an explanation for the E.S., but he said that's the guy. He figured it out. So no one told him I'm Milton Franklin and I wrote the book. Sure. It wasn't that kind of thing. But we have to credit Pratt with really planting the seed or figuring out that. Apparently, his belief was that Milton Franklin Andrews was Erdnase. And then Gardner, following up on that, really built it up and made it a story. And then Bart Whaley, a researcher and historian, filled in all the blanks. So the Man Who Was Erdnase is the life story of Milton Franklin Andrews, as though he had written the book. It's kind of a circular thing. They they argue he wrote the book, but then they also assume he wrote the book, and here's his life story if he wrote the book, and up through his, you know, lurid end, and then the whole history of the book. And Busby had some great information about the content of the book and the various editions of the book and that kind of stuff. So it's a valuable resource. You have to have it if you're interested in this topic at all, and it's not too hard to find.
Mm-hmm. And so who do you believe? I mean,
well, okay, so I got interested. So this book shows up, and it's like, wow, what do we do? We've never had one. We've never sold one. They've sold at auctions. Mm-hmm. They don't come up too often. This one was not in great condition, but it had interesting provenance because Gardner's interesting, and it was signed on the title page by the illustrator. So that was neat. And then in talking to Gardner about it and saying, you know, we really think this should probably be sold at auction, and there's this new thing out there called eBay. I had never bought anything on eBay. I'd never sold anything on eBay. I knew of it. But we said, you know, maybe that would be a good place to sell it. And he said, hey, Gardner, as mathematically literate and astute as he was, you know, I had mathematical games column for years and years, and got a lot of people excited about math. So a lot of our math professors now got their interest as teenagers reading his column in Scientific American. Mm-hmm. And he had a real gift for communicating technical information in a fun way, and just created a whole renaissance in recreational math and interest in it. But he didn't own a computer. He did all of his writing on a typewriter, and then his wife would like hand correct it and stuff. And he had a computer at one time. The story he told us, Gardner, was that his wife took it away from him because he spent so much time playing games on it or something. You know, I don't know if it was you know, probably Pong or something. You know, yeah. That would be the era. But it was not a good match for him. It kept him from doing his writing, and so he went back to the typewriter. But so he didn't know. I mean, he knew about the internet, but he didn't have firsthand experience on it. But he was the one that got enthusiastic. Said, "Yeah, let's give that a try," and to make it more interesting, you know, I've got all these research materials that I did over the years on this Milton Franklin Andrews, mm-hmm. why don't we include that in the sale? So he sent us a box load of manuscripts and newspaper clippings and articles and stuff related to this that we put all in one lot. But we didn't want this to have the first thing we sold on eBay because it's a learning curve. So we sold like an early issue of the Sphinx on eBay and Mahatma or things like that we'd gotten from him as well,
right.
Just to figure it out, to learn it, and to know that we were doing it right. And then we put his whole lot together with a really good description and nice illustrations and set a date for it. And in the meantime, I think there'd been a TOM in Austin. And at that, we talked to Stan Allen about, you know, this thing that we had coming up, this sale of this book. And meanwhile, I had reread Man Who Was Erdnase and mm-hmm. was struck by the discrepancy between the height and the age. And it's like, well, if you believe the illustrator, then Milton Franklin Andrews couldn't be the guy.
Right.
Just to rule him out if you believe the illustrator.
You have to believe one or the other.
Yeah. And they say that in the book, but they also argue why the illustrator is not necessarily to believe. But in the meantime, I had a phone conversation with David Alexander, who claimed to know who Erdnase was, wouldn't tell me, but said it was not Milton Franklin Andrews. But he was kind of poking me with it by saying, you know, it's you're not seeing the forest for the trees. It's so obvious. And it's like, you know, that's kind of an ego thing. It's like, I'm as smart as that guy. If he can figure it out, I can figure it out. So I started to kind of do my own little online thing, and Gardner had a theory at once that, well, maybe his name is not E.S. Andrews. Maybe his name is something spelled backwards that gives you the E.S. So, like, he had a theory for a while that he introduced, and he later was embarrassed by it when he came up with Milton Franklin Andrews. He thought it might have been a James Andrews, because James ends with the letters E.S.
Mm-hmm.
So you spell that, and you drop the M.A.J., that, you know, the first part of the name to make a plausible name. It's a good theory. Mm-hmm. And in fact, later we found in Gardner's correspondence with, I think, the Canadian Copyright Office, he says, hey, I was asking you to look for an E.S. Andrews. Stop looking. I want you to look for a James Andrews. And they say, well, why do you want us to? And he says, well, because I'm in touch with the illustrator, and the illustrator recalled that the man's real name was James. Well, did he recall that?
Yeah.
You know, or was it another prompted thing where Gardner calls him up and says, hey, could his name have been James? Yeah, it could have been, But if Gardner got a call at 2 a.m. saying, gosh, Martin, I remembered, it's James. Well, that's a whole different thing. So we don't really know. But he was very enthusiastic about this James here. And he found a James Andrews that wrote a thing. It was republished in Walter Gibson's Conjurer's Magazine. It was an article in like Vanity Fair or some public magazine that was about a Coney Island fake here. And he was clearly, you know, somewhat of a mixed ethics that, you know, he seemed to have the same Gardner who annotated Alice in Wonderland and Wizard of Oz, L. Frank mm-hmm. Baum. I mean, he had a great literary ear. He mm-hmm. did poetry compilation anthologies and stuff. He thought he heard the same voice in that article by this James Andrews as he heard in the book, and the physical descriptions and things that seemed to match. So he thought for a while that it's just James Andrews. That was before he got to the Milton Franklin Andrews theory through his interaction with Pratt. When he got to that, he abandoned the James and said, I was wrong. It's this other guy. But so I got interested in these other theories, and I think the first one I found might have been I found several E.S. Andrews, because now we got the internet. Gardner didn't have the internet, and you can do all kinds of stuff. So I found a riverboat captain from Canada, and it had a Canadian copyright in the book, so that was kind of intriguing. His name was E.S. Andrews, and I tracked that down for a while. Didn't quite fit. I tracked down a bunch of people, and they'd all be great for a while, and then you'd find something that just you couldn't make that
square peg fit.
Exactly. Yeah. Which just you'd have to do too much chopping to get it to fit. Yeah. And one of the things Gardner found out in his early research was that in his conversation with Marshall Smith, the illustrator, Marshall Smith says, I don't recall his first name or middle initial, but I do remember that he mentioned that he was related to Louis Dalrymple. Now, Louis Dalrymple is not a name that means anything today, but at that time, he was a very famous political cartoonist. So he'd do, Teddy Roosevelt looking silly, charging up San Juan Hill and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And mm-hmm. he illustrated for a number of popular magazines at the time. Judge was one of the names of one of the magazines. And these would be the front cover illustrations of
like
political characters.
Or something.
Yeah, exactly. A very high And this guy said he was related. So Gardner thought, boy, if we can find a gambler named Andrews who's related to Louis Dalrymple, case closed. So he was pursuing that, and he did enough of the Dalrymple genealogy to know that Dalrymple's mother's name was Adelia Seeley, and that he was from Western Illinois. He was from Cambridge, Illinois, was where he was born and raised before he went to back east to study art and worked for the newspapers in New York. There are all kinds of genealogical resources now that, again, Gardner didn't have. He'd have to go to the library and go to the microfilm and all that stuff that now you just push a button on your computer. So I went to my computer, and it turns out all this stuff is happening in Illinois. The book was published in Illinois. Louis Dalrymple was from Illinois. Well, there's an Illinois database, very easy to find, that is all the marriages in Illinois up through like 1901. Mm-hmm. And you can put in a groom's name and a bride's name, just the last names, and it'll see if there are any matches.
Through the genealogy, go all the way back, yeah.
Yeah, so I put in any grooms named Andrews married any brides named Dalrymple. And I don't. If I got hits, they didn't fit.
Yeah,
I don't think I got any hits on that. And I said, well, what about... what about grooms named Andrews who married women named Seeley? And I immediately got a hit, and I was excited. At that time, I had a candidate that I was quite fond of, which was a James Andrews, kind of following up on Gardner's theory. And he was an attorney who had come from a city, Sterling, Illinois, which is not that far from Cambridge, Illinois. They used to be one big county that got split into two counties, and he had moved to Chicago in the 1890s, and there's evidence that Erdnase was in Chicago in the 1890s from some of the research Gardner did. And he self-published a number of books. He was an attorney. He was on the law faculty at University of Chicago, taught postgraduate courses. The books is self-described as a postgraduate course on card manipulation. There were just a lot of things that seemed, boy, I really like this. James DeWitt Andrews, J.D. Andrews was his name. And then he moves to New York in like 1903, which would explain the book dropped in price very shortly after it came out. It was originally priced to sell at $2 a copy. That's printed on the title page, a big price. That'd be like a $40, $50 book nowadays, mm-hmm. So not a cheap book. And the price dropped to $1 less than a year after it came out. The copyright was submitted in March, and the book was half priced by the following February. One of the mysteries is we don't know the marketing of the book. What was the author's? How did he plan to sell it? He says at the end of his famous preface that he doesn't care who buys it or what they do with it as long as they pay for it because he needs the money. Now, that could just be an ironic joke, his sense of humor, mm-hmm. or maybe that's a motivation for writing that kind of a book is you want to make some money.
Right.
So what was his plan for selling it? Who's his market? What's his distribution? We really don't know. The first advertising we have is in a magic magazine. It's in the Sphinx. And it's in like the November issue, March to November. That's a long time to not be selling copies. In the September issue of The Sphinx, there is a one-line mention of it in kind of an editorial column saying interesting new book with some gambling and magic called Expert at the Carte. You know, it's just it doesn't say where to get it, how much it costs, any details of the content. So that's the earliest mention we have. But again, March to September, that's, you know, 6 months. That's a long time. Where is it being sold in between? Anyway, now I got to bring you back to where I was before that, what we were talking about. Oh, Dalrymple. So, so I find it. So I'm looking for maybe, can I relate?
With those two
James DeWitt Andrews, this Chicago lawyer at the time the book comes out, can he be related to Dalrymple? Well, Sterling, Illinois and Cambridge, Illinois, pretty close. And so I'm looking for that. And bingo, I find an Andrews that married a Seeley in Sterling, Illinois, which is where my guy was from. So I says, that's how James Andrews, the attorney, must be related to Dalrymple because he married a Seeley who's related to Dalrymple.
Okay.
And so I start to follow her. Now, I was so hooked on James DeWitt Andrews that I was totally blind to the fact that the man she married was an E.S. Andrews.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
It took me, right in the face.
Took me a long time. His name was Edwin S. Andrews. That's an E.S. Andrews.
Yeah.
Edwin Sumner Andrews. Sumner or Summer. It's not really clear, but it was an E.S. Andrews. But at some point, you know, investigating him, everything I found out about him made him seem like a better match. All the other guys, they start out great, and the more you find out, it gets squeezed and squeezed until finally you can't make them fit anymore. And his, I start out with knowing nothing, and the more I found out, the better he fit, and the better he fit, and the better he fit, and it never kind of fell apart. So he was his profession. I eventually abandoned the James. I tracked down two of James DeWitt Andrews' grandchildren and got, you know, not like, yep, I've got Grandpa's copy on the shelf here, it's autographed to my mom, or none of them, you know, some of them had like weak things like, yeah, my son's a professional blackjack player or something. You know?
Right.
So there's a family, and my mom was a good bridge player, you know, whatever. But it was all very weak. None of them had any anecdotal evidence. And the one granddaughter, the grandson who was younger, never met his grandfather. His older sister, who was in her 80s when I'm sure she's passed away by now, she had met her grandfather when she was 3 years old, and she remembered him as being very tall. Well, who isn't tall to a 3-year-old? You know what I mean?
Sure.
But anyway, he was interesting to me because he was very close friends. Close friends. He was a colleague and friendly terms with Teddy Roosevelt. One of Roosevelt's son had an amateur interest, a serious amateur interest. Alice, probably his most famous daughter from his first wife, had an amateur interest in magic. And they talked about her. There are pictures of her performing magic, like at the White House. Hmm. And it's like, wow, what if Alice took lessons from Erdnase? And I was all excited about that. Anyway, at some point, the James DeWitt Andrews thing wasn't fitting anymore.
So you abandoned that.
Yeah, but before I had jumped ship and gone, I gave this talk at the LA History Conference, which was presented. This was in November. We were selling the book in February.
What year?
This is all part. This is of 1999 is when the conference was, and we sold the book then in February of 2000.
Okay.
And so at the conference. And I'd already agreed from having talked to Stan at the
Magic
Austin
Live.
TOM.
Oh, TOM, yeah.
And we may have talked just to, I think we talked to Mike Caveney at the TOM. I think he and Tina were. It was
were
a Harry Anderson.
Too.
There was a whole left-handed lead evening. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so we talked to Caveney about it because he was organizing the history conference. He said, yeah, that'd be a great presentation. Yeah, why don't you talk about that? And he got David Alexander to talk about and tell publicly who his candidate was and give his research. So we were kind of back-to-back. So I kind of gave the history of how Gardner
got
there.
So Alexander did
he
eventually.
He did at that
and
conference.
And who did he say?
Well, this was if you got enough time, I'll give you the longer
version.
Let me
have to break this into two parts.
Yeah, we got we don't want to miss our planes.
Yeah.
David was nice enough to, so I'd done all this research and I decided it was this James DeWitt Andrews, but then and the connection is through this E.S. Andrews. But I knew enough to know that that wasn't David's candidate, that we'd found different candidates. And I didn't know who his candidate was, but I knew it wasn't the same as my candidate. So I'm still thinking I got the guy. But he was nice enough to say, hey, let me come to you in Charlie's room the night before we give our talks, because I was going to give mine first, which was basically the history of how Gardner got to Milton Franklin Andrews, the problem with that, and an interesting alternative, which would be James DeWitt. And then David was going to come on and say, here's the real guy.
Yeah.
And here's why. And that was basically how it was presented and perceived. But he came in the night before and said, here's who my guy is, kind of gave us a short version of his talk. And it was like, wow, that was, we weren't even close. Yeah. His guy, it's really interesting and a really smart theory, and could be the guy, a very interesting candidate, is a guy named Wilbur Edgerton Sanders. And I said, what does that mean? I know. Yeah. How did he get to Erdnase from that? Well, if you take his first initials, W.E., Wilbur Edgerton, and Sanders, that is a more complex anagram of S.W. Erdnase. His thing is, read it backwards, that's too obvious. If you want to hide your identity, you want it more difficult. Mm-hmm. But if your ego says you got to have your name on the title page so that at least you can recognize it, you're not going to call yourself Mr. Smith. You know, you're going to put something that you recognize, and that legally, because it was copyrighted, you could say, hey, that's a fake name. Here's my real name, and here's the proof. So he looked at all the anagrams of S.W. Erdnase, and he came up with four plausible names. And then he started to look at candidates that fit those names. And he found this Wilbur Edgerton Sanders, a mining engineer from Montana, quite a prominent family. Their family home is a bed and breakfast. We had a little thing there called the Erdnasium, a little Erdnase interest meeting once in his childhood home, which, you know, Ricky Smith and I shared a room, and there was the writing desk. Maybe that's where the expert was written. I don't know. But it was this quite highly organized argument as to getting from, you know, W.E. Sanders. It's really interesting if you look at I think one of the few, there are moves like there's the Erdnase system of palming and the Erdnase system of shuffling and cult shuffling and stuff like that. The only move in the book that is named with his initials, and he makes reference to the fact that he put his initials on it. He says something like, I don't put my initials on this to appear big on the bills, but I just needed to give it a name. It's the S.W.E. shift. Well, what David Alexander argues, if you shift those initials, if you take the S.W.E. and you perform a shift, you can get to W.E.S. It's like, oh, God, all right. Yeah. So it's kind of and he does similar things with the title page that, you know, if you move around and you look at the typography, and some of it ends up seeming kind of like, to an outsider at least, like a Bible code kind of thing. You know, you can get to anywhere from anything if you look at it closely enough.
Well, thank you very much, Richard. I appreciate your insight into your opinion of who may have been S.W. Erdnase. And I mentioned at the first of this podcast, by the way, that we had another one that we had spoken with a person who's a documentarian. Just real quick, it was episode number 383, and that was a chat we had with Jim Davey about his new documentary, which I say new. He's still working on this, and this was back in September of 2017 when we talked. So you can go to the blog at themagicwordpodcast.com, get the information to go back and listen to that episode then again. Very fascinating. And also, be sure and stay tuned then next week, when we will conclude this part of his chat about S.W. Erdnase, as well as his search for some other magicians who have traveled through the plains of the U.S., particularly through Utah, and who had a connection with Brigham Young there and the Mormon religion. Quite interesting. So again, Dick, thank you very much. I appreciate you being a friend, and also for stopping by The Magic Word. All right, well, it looks like we're going to have time for a review of one item that is from Murphy's Magic Supplies that you can purchase from your favorite magic dealer. And this one is called Unseen by Manoj Kashal. And this is effectively trickware that a signed card ends up appearing between the palms of the volunteer. Let me repeat that again. It sounds too good to be true, but this is how that appears. The effect is basically someone has a dollar bill. You fold up the dollar bill. They open their palms, their hand. You place it between their hands. Then a card is selected by somebody at random. Their name is signed on the card. The card vanishes. The other person then lifts their palms. And when they lift their hand, they see that there is now a card that is sandwiched between the folded bill, or between the inside the folded bill, basically. So it's now a full card. So you
bring it back to your hands, and then you give them the bill, let them inspect it. Of course, it's still the same serial number, the same bill. You turn over the card, and it is their signed card. That's the effect. Very cool. Great effect as far as the audience goes, and I like the effect. The thing that I'm not really wild about is that you start dirty and you end up even dirtier, you know. It's one of those things, like, usually you're supposed to start dirty and end clean. This one, you're kind of starting dirty to begin with, and at the end, you're dirtier than what you started with, because the gimmick ends up in your hand along with another gimmick that required this whole thing to work then to begin with. Aside from that, there are a lot of things that can potentially go wrong with this, specifically whenever that you're going to be using threads or elastic or rubber bands or something that can break, you can count on it actually breaking. Because depending upon how often you might perform this, or the conditions where you store it, or how long that you have it between performances where it's not stored properly, that the gimmick could break. And they do not include the additional pieces that you need in order to remake this. Moreover, that in the instructional online DVD, or I should say online instructions, they do not explain how to replace the gimmick should it break. Let me just say, when it breaks, because ultimately it will if you use this often enough or use it improperly. It's something that can break. Not easily, but you'll get a lot of performances out of it probably if handled correctly before it does break. But when it does, of course, it's always the worst possible time. So that's really one of the downsides that I see of this. Actually, a couple of downsides that essentially the deck of cards that you use, you kind of need to dedicate to this trick and then put that away. Moreover, there is a part where he is saying, you know, place the deck down, face down. And when you do, the gimmick is actually showing to the audience. And depending upon whether that you're putting it down, perhaps on a white tablecloth, maybe that they won't see it. But part of the way that you handle this, the way he explains it, is that the gimmick has to be pointed towards the audience and in full view. So again, it's one of those things. A lot of times the magicians worry about these little things, but in actual practice, it may never look obvious, but there might be an opportunity if you're not working in the right conditions. I'm saying with a white tablecloth specifically, that is probably going to be exposed a little bit, and that's not a good thing. But the effect itself, again, is really good from the standpoint that it appears that a card has appeared between under the hand of someone they can place their hands together, or they can place you put the folded bill on under their hand is on the tabletop, and they put their hand on the tabletop. When they lift their hand, now the card is sandwiched between the folds of the bill that's folded in half. I suspect that you could use any currency, but the American dollar bill is just wide enough that it would allow the ends of the bill to be seen easier. I think if you're using some foreign denominations that may be too wide, that would not let the card be fully seen on both sides. Nevertheless, there are some handling gyrations, I guess, basically, kind of some fiddly parts you have to do to get this to work properly. All in all, there are other ways of trying to have a card vanished and reappear, and some other things that it's just another thing you have to carry. And not only just some other things, but also this can be added to an existing deck, but essentially you're going to have to do something and go back and take these cards away to be able to use the deck. Again, they could be palmed off, but there's one on the top and one on the bottom. So anyhow, I can't recommend this a lot. I guess I could with reservations, severe reservations, but it's just an okay trick. But again, mileage may vary. You may like this. This may be something that works perfectly for you. And so it's worth checking out the video to see if it's something that that could work for you. And again, it's called Unseen by Manoj Kaushal. So there you have it. Not all of them are winners, folks. Well, again, this, like all other things, are available from your favorite magic dealer, and they come to us from Murphy's Magic Supplies, and we thank them very much for donating these things to us to allow us to give our honest opinions and reviews of these different new products that are out there. And as I always say, to go out and support your brick-and-mortar magic shop, and if there's not one near you, then go ahead and use that online magic supplier. Well, that's going to be a wrap for this week, and I hope you enjoyed listening to Richard Hatch talk a little bit about the H&R Magic Books creation of the store and how it came about, and also about his search for S.W. Erdenace. So I want to thank again the Portland Magic Jam for sponsoring this program, and don't forget to sign up. That's going to be at their website at portlandmagicjam.com, and that's happening March 22nd through 24th this year, 2019. Next week, be sure to tune in. We hear part two of our chat with Richard, and he talks about some other completely different things that are really quite interesting. I know you're going to enjoy that. If you like magic history, this is the guy you should listen to. He's got some really good stuff to talk about here next week too. And to make sure that you're not missing anything, be sure to sign up for our newsletter. It comes out each week at the same time this podcast does. It lets you know what it is that we're talking about and with whom we are talking each week, as well as who's going to be coming up then the next week, and also a suggestion from the archives who that you should probably go back and take another listen to, or you might have missed it in the first time. So that's all for now. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and why don't you go out and solve some mystery yourself? This is Scotty out.